welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Got Ellen Brown on today. Web of Dead. Everybody knows Web of Dead. Everybody has read Web of Dead, right? Anybody who hasn't read Web of Dead, raise your hand. I don't see any hands, Ellen. I think everybody's read Web of Dead. Well, it tells how the private banking system really works. You know, not the way CNBC, that's right, or Bloomberg or the other people who describe it one way. And Ellen explains it the right way. Not only that, but she explains what the right way is that never gets talked about on CNBC and Bloomberg and Fox and the rest of them. You know, they wouldn't dare tell you what works. They only tell you what doesn't work. Ellen, I want to ask you one question, and then I just want to mention a couple of things before we jump into the program. How's the new book on public banking going?
Well, I have had sort of a nervous breakdown over it lately because it's so slow. You know, I want it to be right.
Absolutely.
And I don't want to have less quality than in Web of Debt, which actually took me 6 years. But I feel like I have to get it out because it's just a subject that if I had it there in writing, it would be easier to explain. You know, it would just all be there. All my data would be there.
Oh, I'm dying to see it. You know I'm dying to see it. And, of course, talk about it innumerable times on this program. I mean, if it comes up the Web of Debt's ankles, it'll be a masterpiece. As far as getting it right, Ellen, do you think Michelangelo could have walked out of the Sistine Chapel saying, well, you know, I didn't quite get it the way I wanted to, but I was rushed. I had to get it out. this Pope, what the hell is his name? He said, get the damn thing finished and get out of here. We don't pay overtime in the chapel.
We're tired of that scaffolding being up there and you on your back.
As he was teetering up, I've only been in Europe once. You've been there a lot of times. But I was in Rome, and I was in the Sistine Chapel. It is quite a place, I must say. It sure looks better than my bedroom, I'll tell you. Or my living room or anything, any other place that I've been in. It's a beautiful place. If anybody gets there in the Vatican Museum, it certainly is something that you want to see. I'll mention one more thing. Besides your book on public banking, Ellen is also the head of the Public Banking Institute. And there's no question Ellen and I agree on everything that Ellen writes about. I get into some other topics that Ellen might mention tangentially, but she does some of the best financial writing I know. I mean, it is really sensational. Every time you spot one of Ellen's articles, you absolutely have to read it. You teach me stuff every time you write an article, Ellen. And I've got another one coming out. I've written about Super Mario and what he's doing in the Eurozone. And I've written about Fed's QE3 and so on and so forth. And several times in this stuff with updated articles when something new breaks, like QE3. Well, I've got another article coming tomorrow, and I quote you in it from your recent article, your newest, and we'll talk about that. Let me just mention a couple of things quickly. Oh, I got to promote a book that Clarity came out with, and my editor asked me to contribute a couple of chapters. The book is called The Illegal War on Libya. It ties right in with another comment I want to make. We all know, well, everybody listening to this program knows that Ambassador Christopher Stevens was killed over there. Not the way the major media reported it, not at all. I'll comment on that very briefly in just a moment. But this book, The Illegal War on Libya, edited by Cynthia McKinney, she contributed to it. It's got a marvelous photo on the cover. Cynthia was in Libya. And she's standing in front of an example of American humanitarian intervention. It is a bombed-out building that really, really is bombed out. I mean, it is just rubble and metal reconstruction wire that is just shredded, and the roof is caved in. It's got half the page on that and the other half a page on the title of the book and Cynthia. And Cynthia is looking off in the distance, and she and I feel the same about this. She was on some weeks back, and we talked about the book. I contributed two chapters that my editor asked me to, Diana Collier, and mine are called A Nuremberg-Level Crime, NATO's Libya War, A Nuremberg-Level Crime. There's no question about it. Mm. And my other article was why Libya was attacked. Multiple reasons. And you wrote about a biggie, Ellen, without question. His own public bank. I mean, that alone is a reason to wage war in a country. they have their own public bank.
I just wrote a chapter on that, on Libya and the other rogue nations, and they all had their own banks, and their banks were all publicly owned, or, you know, predominantly publicly owned. And of course, Iran is the biggest of the Islamic banking centers. 7 out of 10 major Islamic banks are in Iran, which is just a different approach to banking than, I mean, you could call it a religious war, Israel versus Iran, but really it's two different ways to do banking. And one is where the banker gets his pound of flesh no matter what, you know, the interest, compound interest problem. And the other is where it's profit sharing. So if the company doesn't do well, then the bank doesn't do well either, or the bank doesn't. Anyway, the profit share, that's pretty much the Islamic version. But it seems to me there are also problems with Islamic banking. I mean, it's only been a recent development. That obviously, it's not in the Quran exactly how you would do interest-free banking. And whenever they try, the problem is that the bank, it's a private bank. They're still trying to make money. They have to make a profit somewhere. And if you don't charge interest, you're going to have defaults on some of your loans, and you're just going to lose money. I mean, there's no way you can stay in business unless you do it some other way. So really what they have is something very similar to interest, whereas they'll sell the house at like 150% of what its value is, and then you wind up paying that 150% over time.
But
it
no
seems
interest.
To me that would actually serve what they're trying to achieve better is public banking. In other words, if the money actually goes back to the public, it doesn't matter if you charge interest. If it's cutting your taxes and providing welfare of various, you know, social programs of various sorts for the people, if the people are getting the benefit of it, because it's really the people's credit.
Ellen, we need to get you over to Tehran to explain how they can work out the wrinkles in their system. But, of course, their system is certainly not a Wall Street system, and that's one reason for wanting to get rid of the Iranian government and put a puppet regime in its place. The nuclear issue is a complete red herring, but if it wasn't that, it would be something else. Iran's program, there is no evidence whatever that Iran is doing anything illegal. Everything is illegal and above board. And Iran is the only country with a commercial nuclear program, and there are many dozens, including a number in the Middle East. Nobody has a word said about them. I don't think the IAEA, the nuclear watchdog, I don't think they're monitoring anybody. It's an open secret. Everybody knows it, but few talk about it, that Israel is nuclear armed and dangerous. And they began their nuclear weapons program back in the 1950s. I mean, practically right out of the box after they became a nation in 1948, David Ben-Gurion, first prime minister, ordered it. And he got some expert in Europe and got him down, set up a nuclear program. It's got a number of nuclear facilities. The one that's known best is called Dimona. It has nothing to do with commercial nuclear power. It's all military. It's all weapons, and it's well known, and nobody says a word about it. And Israel also has a large chemical and biological weapons arsenal. They keep that even more secretive than the nuclear one. But who goes in and monitors Dimona? Who the IAEA wouldn't even dare ask to go near the place, let alone in the front door, Ellen. But Iran, doing everything peacefully, according to U.S. intelligence, annually, every annual assessment of the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies says there is no evidence whatever that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. So America knows it, and Israel knows it, and all the countries hostile to Iran know it. And yet they keep piling on sanctions, on more sanctions, on more sanctions. They're all illegal because Iran hasn't done anything, committed no crimes. They don't warrant this. So these are illegal acts. I consider them crimes against humanity. And then they want to, I mean, the saber rattling has been going on for years. War plans on the books, Netanyahu in Israel, timelines and red lines and deadlines. I could go on and on. Let me say one more thing about Libya. According to Obama and his minions around him, a terrorist in Libya did it. Killed Ambassador Christopher Stevens, America's man in Libya, who was there during the Libyan war and encouraged it and encouraged the slaughter and the destruction and the mass killing, and they appointed him ambassador. Who else? He was there. He was one of the prime movers, so they gave him a piece of the spoils. Well, Obama, Al-Qaeda did it. The milkman did it. Sorry. Mm-hmm. They didn't do it. Who did it? The story that's never talked about in the major media. There is a strong resistance. The color green, which is Libya's color under Gaddafi, so they call themselves the Green Resistance. And the Jamahiriya was the system that Gaddafi set up. It's been a long time, but we've talked about it on this program. This was the system of sharing the nation's wealth with the Libyan people. Can you imagine a country doing anything as crazy as that? Well, I mean, you could do it any place, but an oil-rich country like Libya, 6 million people, lots of oil wealth. Gaddafi did marvelous things with the money. The people benefited enormously. I mean, all of the essentials in life, they were covered. Subsidized housing, free education, free health care. Newly married couples got a $50,000 stipend. Absolutely unbelievable. He thought that everybody should be started off in life with something. And he didn't want anybody in Libya to be homeless. So Libya had no homeless people. And it really isn't a bad country to be homeless in if you can sleep on the beach. Weather is nice. I mean, kids go down to Florida in the wintertime and sleep on the beach, and they think they're having a vacation. They're partying. But no homelessness in Libya under Gaddafi. There's plenty of homelessness now. I could go on. But the Green Resistance has been extremely strong, and they have been waging war against the puppet regime that America put in and the other key NATO allies. But this was Obama's war, and the other NATO countries went along, and tens of thousands of people were murdered, America's idea of humanitarian intervention, and the country in the northern areas just lay in ruins. One city, Sirte, was literally leveled to the ground. And they're doing it to Syria, and they want to do it to Iran and so on. And, of course, they're doing it to ordinary people. You can wage military war, Ellen, or you could wage financial war, and that's being waged around the world, especially in Western countries and in America and in Israel. And you write so much about this, the good stuff. And QE3, let's talk about QE3. QE1 didn't work. QE2 didn't work. But Greenspan's got he's going to use different colored money. I think that's what his plan is. So what didn't work before will work now, Ellen. Explain why QE3 won't work.
Okay, I will, but I do want to say one more thing about Libya. I think also why Libya and Iran are in the crosshairs and is that, Gaddafi was, you know, stood up and shook a fist and was trying to mobilize the entire African nation to not take the dollar and to pay their bills in gold dinar and so forth. So he was actually very actively, belligerently, you know, I mean, he was out there and sort of defying the world. Well, in Argentina, they now have a woman president. It's Kirchner's wife, because he's retired.
Christine, I think her name is, as a matter of fact.
Christina.
Kirchner, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's some Latin names in the middle there, but...
and, indeed.
I don't remember what they are. And the head of their central bank is also a woman.
So
they're totally defying the old system, but they're doing it very, you know, in a very feminine way. Like they're just saying, well, we heard what you said, but we don't really agree with that. So we think we're going to do it this other way. And they're just doing it, you know, but they're not being defiant or anything. They're just doing it. issuing the credit, like issuing national credit, basically, to do all the things that the country needs, and it's working for them. And Japan is doing it. Like, Japan was belligerent before World War II, and look where it got them. It got them into World War II, and now it's in their constitution that they will not go have any more war. You know, they won't go to war anymore. And so they basically are pretending to be desperately poor when they're not. They're very rich, and they're still the world's largest creditor, but they're putting on the shirt here, or, you know, the hair shirt, and purporting to be heavily in debt when actually their debt is totally to themselves. So anyway, if you do it discreetly, you can get away with it. It's that those who have stood up and, you know, defied that have gotten in trouble.
And that's the secret. If you're heavily indebted, but the debt is domestic instead of being owed to foreign creditors, it's an entirely different situation. Of course, if U.S. debt is very heavily owed to foreign investors, but of course with the Fed doing so much of the buying, now it's going to be mostly mortgage-backed securities, but they can buy treasury, they can buy anything, and they have, or switching long-term for short-term, this Operation Twist. So the Fed is doing, but the Fed has limitless ability to print money as opposed to the ECB that has a different mandate.
Right. So even though we have, $1 trillion debt to China and to Japan, et cetera, the Fed will, the Treasury basically says we're going to lend at this rate. And then if the bonds don't sell, the Fed buys the rest of the bonds. So they manage to keep their interest rate very low. So it doesn't really hurt them that they have foreign creditors. Whereas, like you say, in Euroland, they're actually literally at the mercy of the investors, and if the investors don't want to lend at 6%, then they have to borrow at 7% or 8% or whatever. I guess it was 30% at one point for Greece. So that is the difference, that our central bank will buy up the excess. Unsold bonds.
Oh yeah, there was an absolutely horrendous interest rate in Greece. Rates varying depending on the duration of the debt, but I mean, Greece is effectively bankrupt. So I guess you've got to be a nimble trader, Ellen, to get into Greek debt short or long. Literally, Greece can be here today and gone tomorrow.
You and I both wrote on the European Stabilization Mechanism.
Yeah.
And it appeared that would have forced all the Euroland countries to support whoever was, anybody that this, whoever was in charge of the ESM decided needed money, they would get the money, including the banks. They made it so that the banks could be bailed out, and they could force a bailout from all the countries, which would be basically from the taxpayers. And then it went to the German High Court, and the German High Court recently came out with their ruling, and it looked like they were going to allow this. And so it looked, to you and to me, like a disaster for Europe. But in fact, it turns out that this opinion was so obscurely worded, nobody could really understand it. It went on for pages. And what they actually did was to qualify everything so much that they haven't actually approved it. Basically, what they've said is Germany reserves the right to not pay over a certain amount, and we want to see what all the deals are, and if we don't approve, we have the right to back out of the whole thing. Even though there's no such provision in the ESM, they just said that's constitutional for us. You know, it's in our constitution that we can't abandon our sovereignty, and therefore we have to have these certain restrictions.
They were supposed to have.
So it might bring down the whole whole EU.
Oh, it's hard to imagine they're going to let that happen, but it is possible. I believe, if I remember, and I wrote about the constitutional the High Court of Germany, and I believe they also posted as a temporary decision, and a final one will come, if I remember the date, around December. So I don't know what they're doing, but that's right. The language was vague, so they can twist it any way that they want. It may not be quite the way it was reported. A lot of euphoria when the decision was reported. Again, I can't imagine that they're going to do something to bring down the whole Eurozone, unless Germany decides they've had enough of this stuff. Germany has had to ante up enormous amounts of money to bail out these other countries and banks and so on. I mean, how much money? I mean, Germany is a rock-solid economy, or at least it was. It's starting to weaken a little bit. I think it had at least one negative GDP quarter, and its manufacturing is going down. It's an export machine. But if the rest of the world economy weakens, it obviously will hit Germany. And China, I think, was a big customer, machinery and stuff like that. China's going down. I was shocked in my article for tomorrow. I didn't realize how much the Chinese equity market had tanked, Ellen. It's off 50% from its high. My goodness, is that the canary? Is that the elephant in the coal mine?
Well, maybe, but I don't think so. I think the Chinese economy. I think the Chinese know what they're doing. That, like, all this rumor about this issue of the empty skyscrapers and all these apartment buildings they built and so forth. It's basic Keynesianism, where Keynes said you could have people dig ditches and fill them back up and pay them for that, and it would be good for the economy, because what you want to do is get demand out there. In other words, you want to pay your workers. It would have been much more efficient if they had just paid the workers and, you know, gave them a dividend, social credit style. But still, they've gotten money in the pockets of the workers. And they'll do something with the buildings. It's an asset. Surely they can fill them up with people or something. And if the investors take a loss, these are pretty much the foreign investors, right? So what do they care? It seems to me. I mean, I think they support their SOEs, their state-owned enterprises. They issue credit, all the credit they need for their whatever they. They tell them what to do, you know, what they're supposed to build and all that, but they issue all the credit they need for that, and they don't have to pay those loans back. They used to call them, they're supposed to call them non-performing loans, you know, in order to comply with the World Trade Organization rules, but they never used to bother. I mean, they just kept rolling those loans over, just like the U.S. government keeps rolling over the federal debt. Nobody's ever going to pay off that $16 trillion debt. It's not possible, and it freaks everybody out to call it a debt, but if you just acknowledge that it never was a debt, it was a grant, you know, that's what it is in China. If the debt is owed to the big Chinese banks, which are all owned by the government, there's no problem here. There's no interest owed. I mean, the interest goes back to the government, so it goes back to the people. So that's the secret. If the banks are publicly owned, debt is not a problem, and interest is not a problem, because the interest goes back to us, the people. And Japan and China both have that figured out.
Oh, indeed so. And for sure, you have it figured out. And other economies in the past, including America way back when, had it figured out. And again, I mean, a phrase I like, and I use it not all the time, but every now and then I use it in the article tomorrow. It's not rocket science. It's simple, plain truth. I mean, it's been tried again and again and again. I don't think it's got a failure on its record. You know, I mean, if you only succeed less than 1 in 3 times in baseball, you end up in the Hall of Fame. Well, what do you get if you always succeed? You get thrown out for a system that fails when it comes to banking in America and Western economies. It really is crazy. And Bernanke, I mean, and the arch villain in charge of handing the money to the wrong people for the wrong reason. I mean, this guy is no dummy. My God, if I know what works and you know what works, Ellen, he knows what works. Well, of course, he's just a hired hand. He has a boss. A boss sits on Wall Street. The boss tells him what to do. If he doesn't follow orders, they'll sack him and get somebody else. But why?
Well, there's also the boss in Congress. because, you know, it was suggested, well, a couple, with QE2, I think it was suggested that he could do a lot more good if he would use that money to buy. It was one of their own, you know, one of their own Fed people said that they could use the money to buy state debt and local government debt. And he said, well, if Congress wanted him to do that, they would have to change the Federal Reserve Act because he's only allowed to do it for short-term debt, which isn't really going to, that's not the kind of debt that needs to be funded. So it is Congress that's got the, Congress set up the Fed in the first place. They could undo the damage just by changing the law, but because Congress is owned by the banks and by, you know, the parties can't agree on anything. They're both bent on taking the other party down instead of actually getting anything done. Well, particularly the Republicans are bent on taking the Democrats down. So there's no way that the Federal Reserve Act is going to get modified in Congress, I don't suppose.
Oh, no. Not a chance.
So the whole system is just deadlocked. So that's why it seems to me that the only hope is to go to the local level, or for me, my hope, I mean, I'm just a writer, so I just hope to keep throwing light on these issues. And, like, for example, the reason I wrote that article, Why QE3 Won't Jumpstart the Economy, was, and I really what I was trying to say is it's also not going to create hyperinflation, which everybody freaks out about, because there's just so much misunderstanding about what it is. It's really not going to do anything. I mean, the most it would do, the whole point of it supposedly is to bring down long-term interest rates on mortgages, and maybe possibly it would do a little of that. But even if it brought down the rates that the banks are paying, they're not going to pass that on to homeowners. They don't need to. They've already got, you know, there's not that much homeowner business out there that they're catering to because they don't have the creditworthy borrowers anymore. I mean, they can't continue to pass off a subprime loans the way they used to. Everybody's onto them now, so the regulators are being much more careful, and so the banks have to be much more careful about who they lend to, and there just isn't that much business out there apparently of creditworthy borrowers wanting to take out. I mean, they have to pay like 30 now. They have to pay a sizable down payment and all those things they didn't used to have to do
to buy a home.
Yeah.
As far as interest rates on mortgages, my God, I mean, they are rock bottom cheap. They really are rock bottom cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I paid off my mortgage a number of years ago, 29-year mortgage, as I recall, took it out in 1973. And at the time, I mean, inflation was on the rise at that time. And I felt like I was, you know, not super fortunate, but I got a 7% loan compared to how much higher mortgage rates went after that. Looking back, at the time I didn't know, but looking back, I said, gee, you know, I got a good deal. If I waited a few more years, it would have been much higher. And at the beginning of the 1980s, I think it really was awfully high. But
mm-hmm. We had one for 12%.
12%, yeah, just really outlandish. And I think you can get a either 29 or 30-year mortgage, whatever they're doing now, maybe for something like 3.5%, 3.75%. I mean, that's half what I paid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a tremendous move. So what do you want to do, knock it down another quarter point? That's not going to get you more buyers.
No.
I mean, you've got all these other obstacles in the way of making a purchase. Number one, having a job.
But what it really did was it stimulated the stock market, and that's really good for politics right before an election.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that was the point of it.
Oh, absolutely. Let's take a quick break, Ellen, and then we'll come right back.
Thank you.
welcome back. Gone with Ellen Brown, talking about banking and finance and related things. By the way, Ellen, as we speak, our friend Stephen Salinger, first name Stephen?
Uh-huh.
Right now in Chicago, and you and I met here a few years ago, he's having his annual monetary conference. And exactly what's going on today, I don't know. I know Michael Hudson is participating, or he was scheduled to. Steve Keen, the Australian economist, is part of it. I guess Zarlinga brought him in from Australia. My goodness, that's where he lives. I hope he's got a full house if he's paying airfare and so on from Australia and back. But that's going on. It began, I think, on Friday. It'll run through Sunday. And then I guess every year he ends with a beach party. Well, today it's a little bit nippy in Chicago. It's 51 degrees. It's not exactly beach weather. Of course, today is Saturday. Maybe it'll go up to the high 50s for tomorrow. And if they can't have a weenie roast or something, maybe they can turn on the sterno and get everybody warmed up. Anyway, that's going on right now.
Yeah, I understand they put in their packet two inserts. One was about why public banking is an insult to humanity.
Oh, you're kidding.
He's totally, totally opposed to public banking and totally opposed to my book. Oh, well, so it goes. But Michael Hudson said he was going to say today that everybody should read my article. He said it was a great article. So
the last one that you wrote?
Yeah, yeah. He said that should shake him up a bit.
Well, I hope he talks about it when he speaks. I had no idea that Zarlinga would go that far. That is literally beyond the pale as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you know, it's I've also written about this, that it's we're at the stage. Everybody knows that Wall Street is, that the old model is not working, and we have to have something new. And so we're at the stage where all the money reformers are battling each other. I had this experience in the alternative healthcare movement, where all the alternative people thought the others were quacks, and they were all kind of shooting at each other and bringing each other down, and that's why they never could get together. I mean, we really need a big umbrella. We need to all get together and move. I think we need something that just inflames the grassroots all over the place, and something that moves through the internet. That's our, no longer can we take to the streets, but we can definitely take to the internet, which reaches everywhere. But we're at the stage where we have to sort of work out these wrinkles about theory. And to me, the whole pitch of the AMI thing is the NEED Act. It's the 100% reserve solution. And it simply is not going to work. And that was what my article on QE3 is about, really, that it doesn't matter what's in the bank's reserve account. That is not where the banks get control. In other words, people totally don't understand this whole reserve business. And the fact that the Fed is going to buy billions of dollars worth of mortgage-backed securities off the banks and replace them with dollars is not going to inflate the system, because it's all on the asset side of the balance sheet. This is so complicated, I'm not sure I can even say it in a radio show, but that's what I was writing about. But anyway, the 100% reserve solution assumes that banks create money by creating loans. And that they're supposed to keep 10% back in reserve, and then they can lend the other 90%, and that's created money, like they've double counted it. And if you hold back 100%, that would prevent the banks from creating money, and then you would have some sort of agency at the federal level which would create all the money. It would figure out how much money the economy needed. They wouldn't call it Federal Reserve notes. They would call them U.S. notes, and they'd call in all the Federal Reserve notes and replace them with U.S. notes. And supposedly this would fix the problem, to have the money coming down from on high instead of coming from the banks. But in fact, that's just not the way banking works. Today, the banks already borrow every cent they lend. They do issue the money first, but they have to borrow in order to get the checks out the door. So So when you go to the bank and you take out a loan, let's say it's a $50,000 loan, or let's say you want to buy a house and it's a $500,000 mortgage. So you take out a $500,000 loan. You put up the house as collateral, basically. So so that they write your promise to pay on one side of the books, and that's an asset to themselves. That loan is an asset to themselves. And then they write it on the other side of their books as a liability to themselves, the bank does, because they have agreed to pay $500,000 to your seller as soon as you write a check to the seller. So as soon as the check leaves the bank has to get that money from somewhere else. And they either get it, they can pull it from their reserves, which means deposits that they haven't lent yet, or they can borrow from the Fed funds market, or they can borrow from the money market, or CDs, or all sorts of places where they can get this money. But it's all balance sheet accounting. So every single asset on the asset side has to be balanced against an equal amount on the liability side. So all that money is already borrowed. So if you make them borrow it again in the form of borrowing it all from this entity that's going to issue all the money, you're going to bankrupt the banks. I mean, that's just not where the chokehold is. That's not where the problem is. The problem is that the banks are getting the profits from all these loans. The banks are able to control who gets the loans. They're able to favor their cronies and give themselves very cheap. The banks are getting this 0.25% loans from the Fed, like getting almost free money, and then they're lending it on at 5% or 12% or 18% or whatever they want. So they're making this huge spread. So to me, the problem is that the banks are private. If they were public banks, first of all, they wouldn't be gouging. They wouldn't have any incentive to get huge profits out of the deal. There would be a model.
Oh, dear, we lost Ellen. Hopefully we can get Ellen back. It's been a long time since I took basic accounting, but you got to balance both sides of the ledger, as they say. Yeah, we'll get Ellen back on the phone. You got to balance. Back in at the end of the 1950s, I took a summer course in basic accounting before I went off to the Wharton School in 1958, and that was my last exposure to accounting. Basic accounting isn't all that complicated when you take it step by step by step, but it's been a long time for me, and I didn't become an accountant, so I'd have to go back. I don't even have the textbook, or maybe I do bury it someplace, but I have to go back if I had it and take a look and see exactly what I learned. But I remember the course gave me no trouble at all. But if you get more complicated, you know, to figure out not just basic accounting, but how to steal and get away with it, then it gets a little bit more complicated. But they managed to do that. And even if you mess up, I mean, you get away with it scot-free, because who's going to do anything to you? I mean, if you steal whatever amount you steal, the most that they'll ever do is ask you to give back a tiny fraction of it. And then you go back and steal some more. But it's a very ugly system. Ellen, are you back on?
Yeah, I'm back.
Oh, we got disconnected, and I know you don't know when it happened, but maybe you can backtrack a little bit and pick up from where you left off roughly.
Okay, so the problem with the system is not that banks are creating money. In fact, I think that's where money should be created. It's not really the bank itself that's creating money. It's the borrower. The whole purpose of a bank is to turn IOUs or promises to pay into money. You go to the bank and you show them how you're going to pay it back, and then they give you this form of receipt that you can trade in the marketplace and that everybody accepts. If in a small village, let's say the grocer knows you, and he knows that you've got corn growing and so forth, and you say, give me a loan until, you know, let me buy on credit until my crop comes in, and the grocer's happy to do that because he knows you. But for people he doesn't know, he's going to want this piece of paper that's sort of certified, bona fide, you know, a thing that he knows he can trade in the marketplace. And that's the good of a bank, is it takes people's promises to pay and it turns them into money. So money should actually be originated at the local level, so it actually should be originated at the bank. But it's the borrower who is the ultimate originator of the money. And So I think that's a good system. What's wrong with the system is that the banks are privately owned. They're getting the interest. They're able to determine who gets the money. They send it off to their cronies. They get the very low interest rates from the Fed, and then they can turn around and charge whatever they want to the customers. We don't even need that middleman anymore. You could almost do the whole thing by a computer because everything is so mechanized now. But the whole point is that the profits should go back to the people. It's our credit. It's the full faith and credit of the United States. The banks are not loaning their money. They're not even loaning their depositors' money. They're getting that money anywhere. You know, they're borrowing it from other banks and anywhere they can get it. It's just this huge shell game in order to make it look like they're backing the money with something. So we don't need them to be in the middle determining who gets it and draining huge amounts of profits out of the system.
Well, you mentioned shell game, and that is the title of my article going out tomorrow. I call it QE3 shell game, and my opening line is, now you see it, now you don't. I don't know if anyone will understand what I mean by that, but it sounded good, so I said it anyway. What I mean by that opening statement is, the Fed has already announced that it's going to buy $40 billion every single month of mortgage-backed securities or whatever else they want to buy. $40 billion a month they're going to buy. So the number is out there. We know what it is, but once it's out there, we don't get to see it. So there it is. Now you know that they're doing it, but and now you don't means not a penny of it ends up in your pocket. That's what that opening statement meant. But probably I'm the only one who'll understand it, plus anybody listening to this program paying attention. But I like the title QE3 Shell Game, and your writing inspires mine, Ellen, and your article inspired my wanting to write this one. Then I throw in some economic data, some current economic data. Oh, it is absolutely dismal. And I discovered, I know China's been on the downturn, and I've written a couple of times in fairly recent articles in past weeks that their manufacturing is way down. Their manufacturing is down for 11 consecutive months. Their exports are down. Their stock market is down 50%. My God. I mean, that was the depth of the Dow 50%. Jones, I believe, and the S&P 500 in the depths of 2009 after things crashed with Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and the rest of them in late 2008 after a bear market year, China down 50% and all their economic numbers are down, and China has been a growth engine for the world. Well, that growth engine ain't there anymore, so that doesn't augur particularly well for the world economy, and Europe is in the tank, sinking lower. All of the numbers that I pick up on the Eurozone, Ellen, and the UK, which is not part of the Eurozone. Eastern Europe has been a mess for ages. But the main 17 Eurozone countries, the peripheral ones in the southern end, the so-called PIGS countries, they are in really, really bad trouble. I've written separate articles on Greece and on Spain. I've written about Portugal and Italy and other articles in Ireland, not separate articles on them, but absolutely awful. And the policies aren't helping them. How do you help an economy grow, Ellen, when you get them to go along with your typical IMF scam, you know, structural adjustment and the rest of it? You know, we'll give you this, that, and the other thing, the kitchen sink, but you have to cut your wages and you have to lay people off and cut benefits and slash all kinds of other things and, of course, sell off the state assets at fire sale prices. How do you grow an economy when you do that? Well, of course you don't, and that's the trouble. And that's the ECB plan, that on the one hand, they will give sovereign country, they'll buy sovereign country debt, provided the country requests it, have to request it, at least that's the way that the deal is set out. And the other part of the deal is conditionality. Conditionality means you got to sock it to your own people. Austerity, structural adjustments. There's only so much of this that people will take. The protests kept getting bigger and more vibrant. and sooner or later there's going to be more. I just can't imagine why people in countries like Greece haven't staged an outright rebellion, because they're already impoverished, most of them. Youth unemployment 50%, same in Spain. Overall unemployment in both countries around 25%. And maybe they've rigged the numbers like in America, and the numbers are really higher, but people are really, really suffering. I wrote one example, it was months back, that just gave an example of people, a family that had a small business, and how they're suffering. And even talking about walking down the street in Athens and seeing one store after another boarded up. I mean, just people out of business. How do you run a country like that? But that's what's going on. And I mean, that has to have a terrible ending.
Yeah, but it does. It's a model. You know, it seems to me that we're at the stage where we're testing all these alternatives, and that model clearly does not work. The model of a limited money supply, and you're trying to lend it and relend it, and that's how you get your expansion in the money supply, and all those loans are at interest. The money is just not there to pay principal and interest when the banks only put out the principal. So it's this exponential growth of debt in an economy that exponential doesn't happen in nature. In nature, it has to level out and be sustainable. So the only way you're going to have a sustainable economy is if that, the part that goes up, you know, the interest thing that's growing exponentially, if that is returned to the economy so that it feeds the economy instead of feeding off the economy, then you would have a sustainable economy. But the good of the EU disaster, it seems to me, is that it just shows that's not going to work. So all those people that say, no, we have to maintain the value, that, you know, maintain a stable currency, we can't allow it to inflate. You have to allow it to inflate if you're going to have that sort of compound interest system. The other alternative is to return the interest to the people through a public banking system, which I think would work much better, and we actually have many models globally. It's just that they don't call them that, and that's what I'm writing about, is to point out that this is what's really, well, like Argentina is one, but they're very discreet about how they're doing it. Brazil is another one. A decade ago, Brazil was, or a little before Lula was elected as president, it was the world's largest debtor, unlike Japan, which is the world's largest creditor. They were the world's largest debtor, and a decade later, they were making loans to the IMF, which was, how did they do that? What they did was they took their big development bank, the BNDES, and they made it much, much bigger. And it was publicly owned, a publicly owned development bank, and they made loans to everything in sight that was of a development nature. No derivatives. They don't do any speculation with that bank. But so the president basically, you know, was driving the bank, and the bank was doing all these things that are good for the economy. And where they got the money was, initially they would borrow from the Treasury, and then the Treasury would issue bonds, which are sold to the public. So basically, they're just recycling all that money that's out there. You know, they say we have all this money in the U.S. It's on the sidelines looking for a good investment, but they don't want to invest because nothing's really safe. But we could do the same thing, set up a development bank and recycle that money. People will invest in a government bond because it's guaranteed by the government, and if they would actually give a decent interest rate instead of this, you know, marginal rate that they're giving now.
Terrible, awful.
Yeah.
Little over 1.5% 10-year bond. Unbelievable.
It's totally cut off the retired people who thought they were going to be living on their savings. You can't live on that sort of interest rate, so you're forced to put your money in the stock market, which means you'll probably guess wrong on what the good stocks are, and you'll probably get wiped out.
Well, that's exactly right. Young people, I remember when I was very young, and I didn't know anything, and I started dabbling in the stock market out of school in the 1960s. And at the beginning, everything went fine, Ellen. The economy hadn't rolled over yet, or maybe it had peaked, but it hadn't gone into a downturn. And I thought, oh, this is so easy. My goodness. And I remember one time I had a friend who I played tennis with, and he became my broker. In the end, he made me broker. But I remember one day he invited. It was a day that the markets were open, but it was a holiday, and I was off work. I don't remember what day, what month, or what day it was, what the occasion was. But I know the markets were open, but I didn't have to work that day. And he invited me in to sit in his office for a while, and I spent about half a day there. And I absolutely got mesmerized watching the tape come by. And I owned a few stocks, and it was lovely just watching the symbols of my stocks come by. And if the price went up a tick and then another tick or whatever, oh, this is terrific. Maybe I can end up quitting my day job and just come in here and sit and watch the tape and put my money down and watch the value keep going up and up and up and up. What an easy way to make a living and make a lot of money. Well, I mean, it's terrific when everything is going up, but it's not terrific when it turns around and starts going down. And when it goes down, it comes a lot faster than when it went up.
Right.
It can be exponential if you get into a 2008 situation, September. My goodness. I mean, it felt like the end of the world was coming. So, I mean, the retirees, you put your money into that. When you're young, and I made mistakes, I was very young. I didn't have a lot of money in the market. And I made percentage-wise a very lovely return, and I ended up losing it all plus principal that I put in. But it was the best investment I ever made, Ellen, because it taught me
a lesson.
It taught me the wrong thing to do. Don't do it again. But at the same time, it's very easy to try to do the right thing. And you simply don't know when you might get caught up in a tidal wave going the wrong way, especially when things are manipulated the way they have been in recent years. And that absolutely is the way things are now, where you simply don't know what it means when the market goes up or rallies big or whatever direction it moves in, because most of the trading is manipulated. It's program trading. It's not the average Joe investor putting his or her money in the market. These are the big boys. Computers are doing this trading. They're front-running everybody else, and they can move things up or down, and it's dramatically exhibited on a day a few years ago, and maybe in 2009, I forget, it's been a while, the flash crash day, where the market tanked 1,000 points, and then it got most of it back the same day. Well, markets don't react that way. Maybe if New York City was bombed by I don't know who, you know, I mean, if something drastic really happened, a real life catastrophic event, or I can't imagine a good event that would take the market up that hugely in one day. But if something absolutely disastrous came out of the blue, maybe an earthquake that swallowed Wall Street, well, then Wall Street couldn't trade at all. They couldn't crash 1,000 points. Well, they'd do an offsite or something or other. I mean, that would be very lovely if an earthquake swallowed Wall Street up. But I mean, this was obviously manipulated, and this is the way they run the market, so you just don't know. You're at their mercy.
That was the day that there was a bill on for breaking up the big banks. And it was almost like the big banks said, don't mess with us. Look what we can do. We can drop your market by 1,000 points, and we can turn it right around if we want to. We're in control here. That's what I thought. It was just a threat.
I forgot what the situation was, but there was something that was brewing in the Congress that the bankers absolutely didn't want. So it was just like the old ad that talked about Mother Nature, and you see a lightning bolt and a big storm come on, and then a woman comes on, and an advertisement. I forget what the product was, but the punchline was something like, don't mess with Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Don't mess with Wall Street. They will destroy you. Of course, there's an antidote to that, Ellen. You could take these Wall Street bandits and you could put them behind bars, and they can't do very much in striped suits, the kind that you don't wear neckties with.
In Sweden, I guess it used to be that they paid 50% taxes, and they had their Social Security covered, a good Social Security that you could live on, plus higher education, so they didn't have to sock away $100,000 per child for education, plus medical. So they were covered. You know, they were totally secure in their lives, and they were quite laid back, and life was good. And then they changed the system so that people could do their own investing with their retirement money, and they put them into these collateralized debt obligations that then got wiped out. And so the Swedes are really mad about this change in the system. They want their old system back, which is their old welfare system.
I hope they get it back. But the last time they had an election, they elect rock-hard conservatives. I have no idea why they did that. But Sweden literally did a flip, an absolute flip, from being the most socially progressive economy in Europe many years back now to being one of the most regressive, retrograde economies. And, of course, they're pulling this crap on Julian Assange being a front runner for America so they can ship him over to some dungeon because he blew the whistle and didn't release anything classified. But, you know, I mean, they want to make him look worse than he really was. Quick final comment, Ellen. Oh, my goodness, the hour went by so fast.
Yeah, well, I should just say, because they asked me to, I'm speaking at the Bioneers Conference in October in San Francisco, and there's a conference called the Democracy Collaborative in Wisconsin, in Madison, Wisconsin. It's all on my website, webofdebt.com, and my blog, which is linked to that, and our other website is publicbankinginstitute.org. And I'm also speaking at a conference in Portland.
Oh, you are a peripatetic person, I must say. I mean, your work is absolutely marvelous, Ellen. The one thing I don't envy you on is all of your travels. Oh, it can be so draining, plus all of the stuff you got to go through at airports and the rest of it. But I hope you have them all safe and sound. And we'll end the program the way we began it. Well, the Public Banking Institute, of course, your new book on public banking when it comes out, and we'll talk about it on this program, and Web of Debt, of course. And, Ellen, I look forward to next time when you come back. Oh, take it slow and easy. Get through this marathon of yours, and then settle down and relax a little bit. I look forward to next time. I think we have that all arranged, but I'll send you an email anyway.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Ellen. And join us tomorrow. We'll be back same time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays and Sundays. And on Fridays, our new weekday, we're on at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.